The Life and Opinions of Moff the Dog and of his friend Marilyn Monroe, Andrew O'Hagan. This is a great book. This is fun. This is a fun read. It's actually the dog writes the book, and you can't beat that. You know, this is the best dog-written book I've ever read. You know, my dog scribbles a few things out, but they're incoherent for the most part. Andrew O'Hagan's with us here from London, and let's speak with him right now, if we can. Andrew, are you there?
Yes, I am indeed.
How are you?
Very good, thank you. Very good.
I really enjoyed this book. This was
thank you.
It was a tickle, and at the same time, it was touching, and at the same time, it was it was written by a dog.
Yeah, it's not every day that you find a philosophical dog having its say.
Yeah. The only problem that I see is that the dog was many more times more interesting than the other characters in the book.
Well, I set myself a challenge. You know, trying to write a book where the dog who was telling a story was much cleverer than I was. But that proved to be the case. This was a lively customer.
Yeah. But he is a Scottish dog, so there is some resemblance here.
Well, you know, I don't want to get all nationalistic about it, but if you really look closely, you'll see that European dogs have the edge when it comes to quoting the ancient Greek philosophers, for instance.
Yes. This dog is very... he's well-read.
Yeah.
Which raises the question, how does a dog get to be well-read? I mean, how do
Well, you know, I did... being a self-respecting author, I did do my research and went around the park talking to quite a number of them and listening to the more knowledgeable of the species. And what I discovered was that dogs' great talent is for absorbing everything that they touch. So when they rub up against a human, watch out, they're probably absorbing everything you know, mm-hmm. Including quite a few things you don't know about yourself.
Yeah.
And I always loved the comedy of that, you know. I mean, seriously, growing up, I loved literature where the animals seemed to know more about humans than they knew about themselves.
Yeah.
And I decided this was an opportunity. You know, we've been through a tough few years here on planet Earth, and I thought it was time to let the wisdom of the animals, shout back at the folks.
Yeah. Is there a book that you could cite that's a predecessor of this kind of a narrator?
Well, yeah, there was two in particular that I just loved when I was growing up in Scotland, you know. The first one was Gulliver's Travels, which many listeners will remember. Jonathan Swift's fantastically savage and satirical look about what it is to be human. Mm-hmm. And there's some talking horses in there.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
I always loved those talking horses. I thought they were so wise and witty, and they added a real giggle to your experience of that book. And also George Orwell's famous Animal Farm, of course, which, during a gloomy time for the human race, in the first half of the 20th century, he put words into the farm animals' mouths, which proved truly wise in the end, and comical at the same time. So these were great influences on me when I was a kid.
Yeah. Now this dog actually is a Trotskyite.
Yeah. Yeah, I decided early on that this dog had to have a very strong political view, and also I wanted to give him an excuse to bite the hand of Lillian Hellman at a party in New York. That always seems too important to me. I mean, I don't want to queer the pitch for other writers, but I mean, as far as I'm concerned, you should always have a scene where Lillian Hellman gets bitten. You know, every novel should have that. My old friend Norman Mailer gave me some sound advice when I was a young writer in my 20s. I went to see him in Provincetown. He said, always sock it to Lillian Hellman. That's the only way to go.
Yeah, and Norman's in there too, isn't he? Doesn't he make a brief appearance as well?
Yeah, in fact, I had decided, since I'm a fair-minded kind of person, I decided to give Lillian a few lines having a go at Norman in the book. You know, this was the idea here, was to give people a real sense of fun as they went through this book. You know, Marlon was in company with this dog for the last 2 years of her life, and that dog saw a hell of a lot, you know, that intellectual world of New York and its parties and its snobberies in the early 60s, plus, of course, life on the West Coast with the studios and so on. I wanted to get all that in the book and get into the scenes real people. So that took a lot of research. I mean, that's where the 10 years of writing the book really was spent, getting the real lives onto the page.
Yeah, and that's like 70 dog years.
That's exactly right. Yeah. I mean, I'm actually the oldest dog writer alive. I'm 504.
And the Maltese is like the pinnacle of dogdom. Is that true? At least that's what the dog says.
Well, that's what the dog says. And, he should know. I mean, dogs, of course, turn out to be even more proud and snobbish about their origins than human beings, if that's possible. And this dog, you know, has some reason for claiming that the Maltese is nobility. Of course, as you know, we in the United Kingdom don't care about the nobility at all. That's why we clear a whole year's worth of diary just to attend somebody else's wedding that we're not even invited to when it comes to William and Kate.
Yeah.
But, yeah, this dog has some good fun, I think, at the expense of other people's sense of hierarchies.
Yeah.
And he loves the idea that he's a special item.
Yeah, and he goes back to the historical roots. I guess it must have been Malta where they were bred. Is that right? I assume.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, you find the Maltese turning up in the laps of tyrants, saints, and sinners all the way through human history. Mm-hmm. Napoleon's known to have had a little Maltese under his coat somewhere while he was slaughtering nations.
That's what he was scratching in his tunic. That was a Maltese.
Indeed, he was just feeding treats to this little blonde dog as his tunic. I'm glad you've noticed these things because they are important in the whole march of human history, I think.
Yeah, very much so. But you know what I like also, and we'll get to Marilyn and all this too, but I like the minor characters, the minor animal characters in the book, like the fly in the soup that speak, because the dog can hear all these other animals. All animals speak and they communicate. Do they speak or they communicate how?
Yeah, they speak to each other. And, you know, that's what I discovered when I was putting the book together, that I wanted all the animals to have an accent and a voice of their own, you know. All the cats I wanted to speak in poetry, because if you really think about it, all those guys who write poetry, they really are cats in the end.
Right, yeah, very much.
So we got all that, and also, as you say, the flies, there's a rat running through the center of Manhattan one night in 1961 who speaks pure Brooklynese.
Yeah.
That seems sensible. And,
A little typecasting there.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that, you know, but we have our weaknesses. there are also some bed bugs, of course, typecasting again. They're, of course, they're Cold War Russians.
Yeah.
It seemed to me that bed bugs would have a fertile life in the hospitals and, you know, local dwelling places of Moscow.
Yeah.
So we had a lot of fun with that. I mean, I think that these animals, though, have to... It was important to me that I got their voices, and I spent a lot of time trying to figure that one out.
Yeah. The fly in the soup was my favorite because he got in his last line just before the spoon came down on him.
That
was a beautiful moment.
That's a great end, you know, to any life. You know, that you've just uttered your most clear and precise piece of philosophy, and then a giant spoon comes right down on your head. That's pretty much how life should be, especially if you're in a bowl of soup in the Copacabana.
Yeah, and Marilyn Monroe soup at that.
Yes.
Yeah, so that was pretty special. That was a good way to go. Now, and the backstory on this is that Frank Sinatra gave this dog to Marilyn Monroe as a gift, perhaps the only gift he'd ever given of this type.
Yeah, Frank had a big role in all of this. By the way, I was enjoying the news that you were just laying out for people a minute ago, especially the reference to Hugh Hefner's relationship with people who sometimes seem a bit younger than he is.
Yeah.
Frank Sinatra, of course, had a similar problem. It's so much so that his friend and ours, Dean Martin, once said, "Hey, Frank, I've got ties that are older than some of these girls you're seeing." And that world of Frank Sinatra, I wanted to capture in the book, you know, the Rat Pack and all those guys, because, of course, Marilyn was involved in that scene quite heavily towards the end.
Mm-hmm.
Frank gave her the dog. He'd got the dog from Natalie Wood's mother, who was a bit of a customer, a great stage mother,
right,
a bit devoted to mania of different kinds. But she loved breeding dogs, and she found Marf, the dog that Frank gave to Marilyn.
Yeah.
And he then, you know, Frank was around for those for all of those scenes involving Marilyn and the dog.
Yeah, Mafia Honey, the full name.
Mafia Honey. Yeah, she came up with that name as a joke about, I think you say in America, Frank's alleged mafia connections.
Yeah.
Yeah, and she decided to have a joke at his expense there. He thought that was cute.
Yeah, it was good. Probably the only one ever made that joke to him and got away with it was Marilyn Monroe.
Indeed, and you'll notice if you study the dates, that she only lived for about a year afterwards, so, you know, the jury's out on that one.
Yeah, and then the dog is such a good observer, but he's more than an observer, he's a feeler. He can actually feel what Marilyn... They become friends immediately.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean... you know, there was a serious aspect to this for me, too, among the comedy and the lightheartedness, which was that Marilyn once said, you know, men exploited her and women judged her, but only this dog loved her.
Oh.
I remember hearing that statement a long time ago and thinking, if that dog could speak, and, you know, you know how crazy authors are. Before, no sooner had I had that thought than I was at my typewriter, you know, banging hard on the keys.
Yeah.
And so far as I'm concerned, it was an opportunity because so much has been written and said about Marilyn Monroe, but too much of it, I think, takes away from the essential woman who lived inside that legend. You know, she was a 36-year-old woman when she died, and she was full of comedy and optimism and hope, as well as all the other neuroses and difficulties she had. She made the world laugh, and she was a picture of naturalism and health in post-war America. And I wanted to get back to that and give people a book that somehow revealed the shine that was on her. And I thought only an animal could do that, who wasn't overly bogged down in human concerns. That was my job. I got a call from someone who knew Marilyn, and they said to me, at last, here's a book that Marilyn herself would have enjoyed about herself. So that gave me a buzz to hear that.
Yeah, and she was aspiring towards so much. You know, I love the scene when she goes into the art studio to see the modern art.
Yeah. She had a lot of experiences like that in those last few years. She was really trying to improve herself. Anybody who's, struggled to change their own life and to move on from difficulties or trauma, they'll understand that urge that she had so strongly to get over all the difficulties, the lonely childhood, the reputation for being dumb and so on. Marilyn was a clever woman, and she wanted to carry herself into a new period, and studying art and going to the acting studio with Strasberg and so on was a way of trying to get a hold of herself and build a foundation for the future. Sadly, she didn't make it, but the dog was there to hug her and eventually, with the use of a bit of imagination, to tell a different story.
Yeah. Didn't the dog bite somebody at the Strasberg studio,
yeah,
too?
Yeah, the dog, I decided that I didn't want to have Marf the dog biting too many people. You know, you can't mess with the reader's sympathy like that. But I decided she would certainly be he'd be biting William Hellman, but also Edmund Wilson, another great American literature figure, who deserved biting at some point too. So I thought, what the hell? His hand's getting in the way. Marf has to do his work.
Yeah. He didn't bite Strasberg, though, did he?
No, I didn't bite Strasberg. Yeah. I mean, heaven forfend. I mean, anybody who tried to bite Strasberg would probably come away with a rather rare and disturbing disorder. There was a man who was almost viral in his ambition and self-interest. So,
yeah.
I decided to protect my animal against such bad outcomes. No, I couldn't have him biting Strasberg.
Yeah. Have you had a lot of feedback on the whole Strasberg portrayal in here? I wonder from...
Oh, God, yeah. I've had a lot. There was a dramatization involving Strasberg here, and it got a big reaction. And because this book has traveled out into the world in a bigger way than some of my previous novels, I mean, this is going into so many languages, and there's going to be Russian and Japanese editions, people have really taken to the dog. And I think the portrayal of all the characters has raised the hackles of some individuals. I've had a lot of responses of people who feel very defensive about, even about Lillian Hellman, can you believe it?
Yeah.
but Strasberg, he still has his followers. And but overall, I think the portrait of him is quite sympathetic, because Marilyn did rely on that man, and he did take her very seriously as an actress.
Yeah. And she wanted to play Ibsen and...
Oh, yeah. He made her believe that she was capable of scaling the greatest heights. I mean, at the time of her death, they'd been talking about Marilyn playing Ophelia, of course, in Hamlet, and working on Chekhov and, as you say, Ibsen. She really had great depths of sensitivity in her.
Yeah.
Some people who remember her from all those sex comedies might smirk or be amused at the idea of Marilyn playing very serious parts, but actually she did have it in her.
Yeah.
And those people who worked with her said they'd never seen such raw talent as might have existed on the stage. She never made it on the stage, alas. But Strasberg certainly felt there was a great future for her there.
Yeah, and you know what? The Misfits, I thought she was great in The Misfits.
That's a
terrific
good movie, man.
Yeah.
I mean, that's an important film. And the American canon, it sort of catches something about the end of the Old West. And great performers in that, giving their last performances. There's Clark Gable, right. His last film. Of course, it's Marilyn's last film. It's one of the last films of Montgomery Clift. Great stars, an absolutely compelling portrait of a changing America. Very beautiful movie that I think quite underrated.
Yeah. And I'm sure you noticed the New York Times came out with this what's it called here? Like, I mean, it's basically Marilyn in New York, those 2 years or whatever.
Yes.
And I'm sure it's a tribute to your book and everything. They went and looked all this stuff up again.
It was very nice of them to mention the book. I mean, they've been supporters of this book, and it was lovely to see even the very straight-faced critics of the New York Times picking up on Martha Dog's sensibility, because for me it was always about a sensibility. I wanted to take time out to give readers an experience of the mid-20th century in America, which had fun as well as darkness. People will remember it was the period of duck and cover and fear of nuclear annihilation. Mm-hmm. But it was also the period of Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis and Marilyn Monroe. And we'd want to get a strong sense of what a incredibly mixed-up time it was.
Yeah, it certainly was. As I recall, of course, I was just a toddler.
Yes, of course. One might even say, you know, that was before you would ever thought about it, maybe.
Yeah, possibly. Possibly one could say that. Well, it's a wonderful book, The Life and Opinions of Maff the Dog and His Friend Marilyn Monroe. And are we going to see, is this going to start a trend of other animal-written
books? Well, you know how
books?
It is with we people who write about animals, you know, the great example being Lassie. It wasn't enough to have Lassie come home. You had to have the further adventures of Lassie and the further adventures of the further adventures.
Yeah.
In fact, I'm sure that as we speak, there's a little cottage industry somewhere in Poland turning out the deepening philosophical disquisitions of Lassie, and that will go on for centuries. The answer is, at some point, I'd like to turn to Maff again, because he really seems to have gotten the right side of people, and I'd like to show readers what happened to him in the years after Marilyn.
Yeah, what where does he go from Marilyn?
Well, it's interesting what comes up in the period of manic research. You know, when I was closing down my researches on Maff, I realized that after Marilyn died, he was taken by her publicist, who went to a new job working for Robert Kennedy at the White House.
Oh.
And I was told by somebody that the dog stayed there in and around the Oval Office through the Kennedy years, the Johnson years, and into the Nixon years, and died the week that Nixon resigned. An event that your listeners will remember. So it might be more tempting than I can bear.
Yeah, this dog is a gold mine.
I would have thought so. I mean, I'll go back to him at some point. But
For
now, what we have is this lovely dog in the company of Marilyn, a great American historical figure, and I hope people enjoy that.
Yeah, I'm sure they will. Andrew, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Andrew O'Hagan, ladies and gentlemen, The Life and Opinions of Moff the Dog and His Friend Marilyn Monroe.